Many people still don't think same-sex marriage will affect them.
I even put this concern to the chairman at the time of the school committee. A little girl saying, I love my girlfriend, I must be gay. And he said, David, I have no problem with that whatsoever.
In our new documentary, The Problem with Same-Sex Marriage, we sent our crews out to document the impact of same-sex marriage. You'll be surprised by what we found.
The little black book, Queer in the 21st Century, it tells kids how to perform homosexual sex acts.
Here we have government officials directly attacking a major world religion for its doctrinal teaching.
The president is being hypocritical in his stances. He is defending his federal health care law in court, and yet DOMA has been upheld 4 times in federal court, and yet he's decided it doesn't deserve to be defended.
The words carved in stone above the entrance to the United States Supreme Court say equal justice under law. But since the court issued its Roe v. Wade ruling in 1973, justice for 50 million Americans is forever lost. Hello, my name is Tony Perkins. The United States Supreme Court is across the street from the U.S. Capitol here in Washington, D.C. Laws passed on that side of the street can be changed every 2 years when citizens vote in a new Congress. But decisions made on this side of the street and the United States Supreme Court are far more permanent. Roe v. Wade is but one example. We're still living with the incredible cost of that infamous Supreme Court decision. But I'm not here today to plead with you for the lives of the unborn, even though that would be a very worthy cause. I'm here today to show you the impact of same-sex marriage on your sons and daughters. Same-sex marriage is currently recognized in 5 states. Meanwhile, 30 states have enacted constitutional amendments that define marriage as a union of one man and one woman. But that could all change based upon what the Supreme Court decides.
I think it's very likely that the Defense of Marriage Act is going to end up before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Federal DOMA, or the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, was enacted in 1996 by an overwhelming margin in Congress. Signed into law by President Clinton, has now been the law of the land for 15 plus years. This law defines marriage for all purposes under federal law, which we know there are 1,100 plus places in federal law where marriage intersects with federal law. Defines marriage as the union of one man and one woman. But this is being challenged by advocates who want same-sex marriage.
DOMA not only had a setback in a recent court case, it also lost its primary defender.
The Attorney General wrote a letter to members of Congress stating that they, meaning the Department of Justice, was no longer going to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in court. They based this on their view that it was unconstitutional.
It's not up to the President of the United States to determine if something is constitutional or not. That's what we have the courts for. And so he ought to defend the law and let the courts decide on any constitutionality.
The basis that they're using to attack this statute is that there is some sort of, quote, right in the Constitution to homosexual marriage. Well, if that right exists, then that's in the federal Constitution. It now completely trumps every state law, every state constitution, and essentially what they will have done is forced same-sex marriage on the entire country without anybody even having the right to vote on it.
I was offended because it is the job of the president. The president of the United States takes an oath of office to uphold the laws of the nation, and it is the rule of law that separates us from some of the regimes across the world where you have so much lawlessness.
The president is being hypocritical in his stances, where on the one hand, he is defending his federal health care law in court, even though there have been 2 federal judges that have ruled it unconstitutional. And yet DOMA has been upheld 4 times in federal court, And yet he's decided it doesn't deserve to be defended and has instructed his Justice Department to not defend it anymore. It doesn't make any sense at all.
The Defense of Marriage Act, known also as DOMA, defines marriage for federal purposes as the union of one man and one woman. The law also prevents one state from imposing same-sex marriage on another state. The law is currently being challenged in at least 10 pending cases across the nation. One will most likely find its way to the Supreme Court very soon. The outcome of that case could change the definition of marriage nationwide forever. In 2003, when the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts mandated same-sex marriage, there was no way to know the full impact of that decision. But today, more than 8 years later, there is clear evidence showing the problems associated with same-sex marriage.
We in Massachusetts have had same-sex marriage forced upon us for 7 years now. And the first level of impact is in our schools. From kindergarten through 12th grade and beyond, our children are being indoctrinated on same-sex marriage and the rightness, the correctness of homosexuality.
The beginning of 2005, our son Jacob was going into kindergarten, and he came home with a diversity book bag. And in the diversity book bag was a book entitled Who's in a Family by Robert Scutch. And that introduces children to same-sex households.
Back in March of this year, our son came home Friday afternoon and bounded in the front door and said, "Mom, Dad, guess what? Our teacher read us the funniest book. It was so silly. It was about a prince who was getting married, but he didn't marry a princess. He married a prince." That afternoon, we sent the teacher an email message. The teacher called back and said that, yes, it was a book about two princes who got married. King and King. It's a story that introduces the idea of men having a romantic relationship and getting married.
Mm.
We were shocked.
And your son is how old?
He's 7 years old in second grade.
And they read this book to him?
Yes, in the formal classroom setting with his teacher as an authority figure presenting this concept as something that is good and right and the way things should be.
After the diversity book bag came home, we realized that the intention of the administrators and teachers was to affirm these relationships and gay marriage in the minds of children. When we went into the school, what we requested is parental notification when these issues are brought up by adults within the school and the option to opt our child out of this type of indoctrination.
And then she said, well, she had checked with the administrators and they had said that this was not a parental notification issue.
One of the reasons they give is they said same-sex marriage is legal in Massachusetts. Therefore, we can broach it anytime with your child.
So when she would not acknowledge our parental rights in this area, we then went to our Judeo-Christian beliefs and our faith and said, well, you wish to affirm homosexuality to our son. You're presenting that which is sin as though it is not to our son, and we cannot allow that.
To make a long story short, the accommodation they gave was to put me in handcuffs and send me to jail. And they were willing to handcuff a father and send him to jail. It was a 6x8 cell, filthy. But, you know, I felt I didn't have a choice at that point. In order to fulfill my role and duty as a father.
So we filed a lawsuit. Long story short, the district court said that they didn't think we have a parental right to be notified in this.
The federal court judge Mark Wolf ruled to dismiss our case. Every citizen should take the time to go read his judgment. He spoke about this book, Changing Minds, in which, to paraphrase, he believes that it's the school's job to change the minds of the young children, that they are indeed young and impressionable.
So it's translating directly into what the courts did on gay marriage and then teaching the children it's okay. And in fact, you could be gay too. I even put this concern to the chairman at the time of the school committee. A little girl saying, "I love my girlfriend, I must be gay." And he said, David, I have no problem with that whatsoever, about children being told this and thinking they're gay at a very early age.
One mother shared with me how she and her son were out doing yard work, and a neighborhood child came up and asked, at the age of 6 or 7 years old, if it was all right for this little boy to marry her son when he grew up. And the mother was aghast and said, well, no, of course not. That wouldn't be right. And the little boy said, oh, yes, in Massachusetts, I can marry a man when I grow up.
Children and teenagers are at a time in life where they're still figuring out who they are and what they like, and their identity is still evolving. And so when they begin to label themselves as homosexual, gay, or lesbian, bisexual, when they adopt those labels at a time in life when they're still evolving, that can have the effect of closing out other options for themselves.
My name is Brian Kamiker. I'm president of Mass Resistance, pro-family group in Massachusetts. Here's an example of something that was at Brookline High. The little black book, Queer in the 21st Century. This was picked up at Brookline High School at a gathering of teachers and kids pushing the gay agenda at that school. This is so disgusting that I can't really read it to you. It tells kids how to safely perform a variety of homosexual sex acts. It tells where you can meet other kids who are homosexual or homosexual men. It was published by the AIDS Action Committee with money, as it says, from the Boston Department of Health, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and other groups that get public money. The Holy Grail is same-sex marriage is legal, therefore you can't stop us from talking about it.
We're looking at the problems with same-sex marriage, how it becomes a legal platform for exposing our children to homosexual material. We've seen the problems with introducing elementary school kids to same-sex marriage and how same-sex marriage inevitably undermines parental rights. Now let's look at another problem, the incredible impact on at-risk children who are placed in same-sex households.
Sometimes homosexual activists will argue that children raised by homosexual parents are no different from children raised by heterosexual parents. Unfortunately, the evidence simply does not support that. And there was a study conducted recently which looked at the family histories of 262 children raised by homosexual fathers or lesbian mothers. And it found that the percentages of children of homosexual parents who themselves became something other than heterosexual, gay, lesbian, bisexual, or unsure of their sexual orientation, ranged from 16% of those children to as high as 57% of those children. Daughters of lesbian mothers had the highest rates, anywhere from 33 to 57%. Just to understand, the percentage of the total American population that identify themselves as either homosexual or bisexual was 3.5%, according to a very recent study. If you want to talk about the ratio, it's somewhere from 5 to 15 times as likely to be homosexual or bisexual as the general population. Children raised by homosexual parents turn out very differently from children raised by heterosexual parents.
We've looked at several ways same-sex marriage harms our children. Now let's look at another type of problem with it. Believe it or not, all Americans already have equal rights guaranteed by our Constitution. And it's no accident that our founders in the First Amendment put religious freedom first, before free speech, before freedom of the press, and even before our right to assemble to present our grievances.
When we look at the impact of same-sex marriage on free speech, this is a cognate of religious liberty.
The first liberty in the First Amendment is religious liberty. Unless we're free to believe what we believe, we cannot speak it, that's the freedom of speech. We cannot publish it, that's the freedom of the press. We cannot assemble on its basis, the freedom of assembly. And we cannot challenge the government, that's the freedom of the redress of grievances. So religious liberty is the big one. If you don't have that, you have no other liberties. And so it ultimately is a theological issue between a sexuality given by the God of Genesis 1 and 2, the one true creator, or any other idea outside the Bible.
Setting Love and Order, I wrote Setting Love and Order about 15 years ago, it was published. And the reason I wrote it was to, one, tell my story of coming out of homosexuality after seeking for Christ. So I use my story in the book as a thread to show that homosexuality can be changed. And after writing the book, I got married and had 5 children. As the movement to protect the rights of men and women who self-identify as gays and lesbians grew, hate speech laws came into existence. And the overbroad application of these hate speech laws and regulations caused some books, such as mine, to go out of print. And the reason that occurred is that there was a covert discrimination against a Christian understanding of homosexuality. So, for example, in the French-speaking world, my book was available only upon request and in bookstores, and then it was kept under the counter. And what happened over time is that it was declared, actually on French television at one point, to be a dangerous book. The important thing is that for those of us who don't want to self-identify as gay, whose same-sex attractions are unwanted, we now have to fight for our right to seek out this kind of help. For example, recently, Julia Ward at Eastern Michigan University was removed from the graduate program when she, as a Christian, said that in good conscience, she could not give counseling to a gay couple. She talked to her supervisor in her program, and the supervisor said, well, just assign them another counselor in training. And so that's what happened. And unless she signs on the dotted line of a particular ideology regarding same-sex attraction, she can't get her education.
Legal experts agree that religious freedom and same-sex marriage cannot coexist. One big problem with same-sex marriage is that it reinforces false assumptions that are all over the internet and in the media. How many times have you read or heard that change is not possible for homosexuals? In fact, those same people will say that change is even harmful and should not be attempted.
I always just assumed I must have been born this way because I felt pretty at home in my relationships with women. And so I just made a conclusion that this must be who I am and I'm born this way.
While the general public seems to believe that people are born gay and can't change, that has not been the conclusion of researchers. There are so many people who find themselves with homosexual attractions and don't want to be homosexual. They don't want to identify as gay. They want another option for their lives.
People tell me all the time that you cannot change. But effectively what they're telling me is what my story is, and I'm telling you that I've changed. Change is very real in my life. I'm not the person I was 7 years ago. I'm no longer Frank the gay guy. I'm just Frank. And there's freedom in that, in knowing that it's not all tied up in that, in homosexuality.
I have been dealing with same-sex attraction since I was a boy. I remember it back as early as 7 or 8 years old. My wife, Lorraine, and I have been married just about 27 years, and there have been difficult times. It's not been an easy marriage, and much of that struggle has related to the inner turmoil that I deal with in walking out same-sex attraction.
I chose to stay married to Jerry, even though he was struggling with same-sex attraction, because I believe God chose us to be married.
I believe that there's a God that created me and designed me, and his plan is the one that's going to work best for me.
He calls us to be together as man and woman as long as we should live. I'm happy that I've stayed with that choice because life has gotten better and better, actually. we're in a great stage in our relationship right now.
Well, there's a lot of debate regarding the issue of whether a change is possible, that someone can authentically change their sexual orientation. Exodus definitely believes that orientation can change. It's representative in thousands of men's and women's lives that have made a shift in their orientation. I would be an example of that. Someone who was exclusively same-sex attracted for most of his life and experienced a significant shift in orientation to the point to where I can be happily married to my wife and have a fulfilling and deep marriage.
This is a deeply personal subject to me because I not only work with men who are in conflict over their homosexuality, I have been a man in conflict with his homosexuality and know very well what it's like to reach a point of saying, Lord, I have this condition, I did not ask for it, but I don't know what to do about it. Where do I go from here?
My name is Joanne Hiley, and I definitely had problems with lesbianism for 10 years of my life, ages 13 to 23. And I did have complete freedom from homosexuality. I had no desire for any woman. I was crazy about my husband. Over the 33 years that I've been counseling people, I've actually counseled one-to-one around 1,500 people. I just rejoice in God and in His power to set people free from homosexuality. So, you know, they can say all they want to about how no one can change, but they can't fool me. I see it and I work with it, and it's real.
And really, when I received the piece of paper from the health department that said, you know, that I had contracted HIV, you know, it was right there. It was a death sentence.
There are many people who claim that it's harmful for a therapist to try to help someone change in their sexual orientation. And so when clients come in saying, I have these attractions, these homosexual attractions, and I don't want to be gay, there are many people that say therapists should not assist those clients in achieving their goals for their lives because it's harmful. Yet the research reveals that it is not harmful. There have never been research studies that have concluded that therapeutic attempts to change sexual orientation are harmful. In fact, it's unethical not to assist a client in seeking to accomplish their goals for their lives, including their goals of living a life beyond their homosexual attractions.
One last problem we see with same-sex marriage is simply a question. Is it really marriage?
Be ye well assured that so many as are coupled together otherwise than God's word doth allow are not joined together by God, neither is their matrimony lawful.
In Christianity, we could never say that there is such a thing as same-sex marriage because we only have one definition of marriage, and that's between a man and a woman.
From the word go, human sexuality is meant to be diversity in service to unity. The two become one.
So same-sex marriage is a contradiction in terms, because marriage, according to the Judeo-Christian understanding, is two people who are other coming together into a union, and their very otherness causes a bond to happen.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here in the sight of God and in the face of this congregation to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony.
Any form of sexual expression apart from a monogamous heterosexual marital union falls short of our Creator's intentions. And because it falls short of His intentions, we reject it as being both sinful and unhealthy.
Sex, according to God, is becoming one flesh. And if you become one flesh as God intends, the sex organs of the same sex will not become one flesh. There is no way.
Duly considering the causes for which matrimony was ordained. First, it was ordained for the increase of mankind, according to the will of God, and that children might be brought up in the fear and nurture of the Lord, and to the praise of His holy name.
The primary purpose of marriage is still, no matter how many times they want to deny it and curse it, the primary purpose of marriage is still the propagation, the procreation of the human race.
In Psalm 11:3, it says, when the foundations are being destroyed, what can the righteous do? We've shown you many problems with same-sex marriage, but an even bigger problem is the state of the institution of marriage in America today. The statistical evidence is quite clear. Rampant divorce and fatherless homes are such serious problems that some may see the situation as hopeless and say that we should simply accept these trends along with same-sex marriage.
The destruction of marriage has not been coming from homosexual people. It's been coming from men and women who give themselves permission to commit adultery, to use pornography, to neglect each other sexually and emotionally, and to, in essence, not take seriously the covenant they've entered into.
Leave the whole gay couple issue aside. Nationally, we have a major crisis of male and female having the capacity to stay together. 55% of American kids have experienced their parents rejecting each other. American men and women began to become sexually dysfunctional back in the 50s and 60s. I think their parents started before that. That generation gave rise to the kids of the sexual revolution. The revolution had already started in the beds of their married parents. And the destruction of society at its basic and most fundamental level started.
God offers us a different path. Let's renew our personal commitment to our own marriage, making it everything God intended it to be. Letting your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. What to do about all of this? Well, remember, we don't elect judges to the Supreme Court. We elect a president who nominates these justices, and we elect a Senate that confirms them. Then they serve for life. So, who you choose as your senators and who you choose as your next president makes all the difference on these critical moral and social issues like life and marriage. 80% of Americans identify themselves as Christian. With the Supreme Court in mind, I encourage you to open your Bible and do what it says in 1 Timothy chapter 2. We're all commanded to pray for all of our leaders and those in authority so that we might lead peaceful and quiet lives. Pick a justice, pick one that you agree with and one that you don't, and pray for both of them on a regular basis. Thank you for watching this sobering presentation about the realities associated with same-sex marriage. For the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., I'm Tony Perkins.
Forward Boldly. I'm your host, Christine Niles, and today I'm speaking with Robert Riley, author of the recently published book, Making Gay Okay, How Rationalizing Homosexual Behavior is Changing Everything. Mr. Riley has worked as special assistant to President Ronald Reagan. He's also been senior advisor for public diplomacy at the U.S. Embassy in Bern, Switzerland, senior advisor to the Iraqi Information Ministry during Operation Iraqi Freedom, along with a host of other prestigious positions. He's author of a number of books on foreign policy, Islam, as well as music. And today he's here to talk about his book on the homosexualist agenda and how it's changing society for the worse. So, Mr. Riley, it's wonderful to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Delight to be with you.
We should make clear at the outset what you yourself made clear in the book, and it goes without saying. You said that this critique of the homosexual cause is not an attack on homosexuals, nor is it generated by any animus against them. Of course, that goes without saying, but, you know, we want to make that clear in case people get the wrong idea. And I just want to commend you for publishing this book. It's controversial. It shouldn't be controversial, but it is in this day and age, and it's just gotten rave reviews. So it's taken a bit of courage, I think, for you to publish this. So I want to commend you for that.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. And it is essential always to make the distinction between judging a person and judging an act. Americans get very confused because they're not that well versed in critical thinking. Some have homosexual friends or members of their family, and they think it's some form of betrayal unless you embrace what they're doing. But we're not called upon to judge other people. That's God's job, not ours. But we are given the ability to discern good from evil in actions. And in fact, it's obligatory for us to use our reason to arrive upon what is good and what constitutes human flourishing. So we can address the moral character of acts. We know that lying is wrong. We know that murder is wrong. We know that sex outside of spousal relations is wrong. And in each of these instances, we can know what's wrong according to what we are as human beings. And that's why I make the argument from reason. There's nothing in my book about religion. I don't quote any scriptures. This is addressed simply from reason.
Absolutely. I'd be interested to know, have you gotten a lot of negative backlash from this book?
Sure. You know, this may sound too self-congratulatory, but I came across a wonderful quote from George Orwell the other day that said, the more a society drifts from truth, the more it will hate those who speak it. So this is not, what I'm saying is not welcome. As we know, the rationalization for homosexual misbehavior is rolling through the courts, overturning all the state constitutions that had defined marriages between a man and a woman, as well as obliterating the Federal Marriage Act, which had defined marriage that way in terms of federal law. And of course, the media is completely taken with this notion of the normative character of homosexual acts, meaning if they're normative, they're moral, they should be sanctified, homosexuals should become priests and bishops and teachers, and we should all be taught the new norm of homosexual behavior. And if you say, wait a minute, there's something intrinsically morally disordered in this behavior, and promoting it as moral is in itself a great evil because it's a lie about what human beings are.
Exactly. Of course, Oregon has become the latest state, the 18th, to legalize same-sex marriage. And on that topic, I appreciated the article that you sent me that you just had published called Love in a Time of Unreality. I think you so succinctly summarize why there's really no such thing as same-sex so-called marriage. I want to read just a short excerpt here because the way you explain it, it's just so clear, common sense, and so succinct. You write here, spousal love is both unitive and procreative. That is what defines marriage and why it is necessarily heterosexual by the nature of what it is. Two men and two women may love each other, but they cannot have a love that is either unitive or procreative, which is why they are not spouses in reality. The only type of love which it is right to express sexually is spousal love, because it's uniquely unitive and procreative. Using sex to express the other types of love is a sure sign that it is not love which is being expressed. I think that's very clear.
Well, thank you. And that statement comes from an examination of the purposes, the inbuilt ends of our sexual powers. Just as we can know that an eye is for seeing and an ear for hearing, we can know our sexual organs are ordered toward the unitive and the procreative. And those ends are met uniquely in a spousal relationship in a marriage. And any activity outside of that spousal relationship is a frustration of those ends and therefore a misuse of the sexual powers. Now, you don't have to be Benedict the 16th to figure this out. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle all understood this. Aristotle in the Politics began with a man and a woman in a marriage as the pre-political foundation of life. The necessary beginning for a village, for a political order, for a city, etc. And he recognized that the principle of the family is chastity, because chastity regulates the exclusive sexual relationship between a husband and a wife. And anything that violates that principle of chastity therefore undermines not only that family and that marriage, but the political order itself, which depends upon, for its existence, that pre-political institution of the family. Therefore, Aristotle concludes that chastity is the political principle. Now, he never discussed the possibility of a homosexual family because the act of sodomy is an act of unchastity, and you cannot have a family based upon a principle which is antithetical to it, meaning chastity. So it's a contradiction in terms. And that's why no one really, throughout our history, has ever considered such an institution until about 10 years ago in the Netherlands. And I think you mentioned Oregon. I think that the decision by the federal district court judge, Michael McShane, illustrates how much is lost or how much has to be ignored to embrace homosexual marriage. I'll just read this sentence from his ruling. I believe that if we can look for a moment past gender and sexuality, we can see in these, meaning same-sex plaintiffs, nothing more or less than our own families, families who we would expect our Constitution to protect, if not exalt in equal measure, unquote. So we're supposed to look past gender and sexuality in marriage.
But makes families, no sense.
Families can't exist without the exercise. They can't be generated without precisely that differentiation in sexuality. So to look past it means to obliterate it. And it is this profound denial of reality that is eating away at the United States, and it's affecting far more than the tiny homosexual population.
Let's turn for a moment then to your book, because the first part is titled The Rationalization and How It Works. And you spend some time exploring the influence of Aristotle, how that was eventually replaced by the thought of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And you write here in your book, Rousseau turned Aristotle's notion of nature on its head. Aristotle said that nature defined not only what man is, but what he should be. Rousseau countered that nature is not an end, a telos, but a beginning. Man's end is his beginning, or as Alan Bloom expressed it, there are not ends, only possibilities. So for our listeners, could you explain this paradigm shift from Aristotle to Rousseau and how it's contributed to this current rationalization of behaviors that were once universally understood to be unnatural?
Right. Well, Aristotle developed the notion of these laws of nature that are constituted by our essence about how we are made, just as we can know the eye is for seeing and so forth. The larger question is, what is man for? And he's constituted for happiness, said Aristotle, which can only be reached through virtue. Now, let's say a popularizer in the 20th century of Rousseau's thoughts, John Dewey, put it rather well, when he said man's nature is to have no nature. In other words, a complete denial of Aristotle and the notion that our ends are inbuilt into the way we're made. Here it's saying that we can make of ourselves whatever we will and have the power to do. And that's the huge shift. And what we will is dominated by our passions. And therefore, reason is demoted from the means by which we come to know our purposes and the aims toward which we need to order our lives to a servant of the passions. In other words, reason becomes a tool simply to find out the easiest way to satisfy our passions. And that, by the way, when you asked me, am I vilified for what I'm saying, I understand what's happening here. People who have surrendered reason and are dominated by their passions, which passion they think is love, can only understand an opposition to it as coming from another passion, which they then think is hate. That's the only way in they have left of understanding things. When I try to say, no, you don't understand, I'm not arguing from any passion whatsoever, but from reason concerning what things are, what is, because we don't get to make up how we're constituted as human beings or how the world is made. It's already made. We simply experience it and try to come to understand how it works and what it's meant for. So if you deny it doesn't have a nature, Then, by the way, there are no laws of nature, or nature's God. And the philosophical and political foundations of this country evaporate. In fact, in most of these judges' decisions overturning the definition of marriage, you can see the denial of the fundamental understanding of that there are laws of nature and of nature's God. Because you cannot say that there is a natural right to do something unnatural,
right,
which is what they say there is.
Right.
So they're denying. The founders of the United States would be absolutely appalled at this travesty.
You know, you also spend some time detailing a number of ancient cultures in your book, examining exactly what their attitude was towards sodomy. And, you know, what would you say to those who, for instance, point to Greek culture to argue that, well, sodomy was embraced and accepted there, and therefore there were some places where it was accepted?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. And as you know, I spend some time examining that, particularly in ancient Athens, where there wasn't a word for homosexuality until the late 19th century. And what was accepted only in the upper strata of Greek society was a mentoring relationship between a man and a young boy, which was pederastic. But no one was understood to be a homosexual in the sense that this mentoring relationship would end as soon as the youth came of age and he was expected to get married and found a family. So they would have been very puzzled by the whole idea of homosexual. And many of these mentoring relationships, by the way, did not involve sodomy. Sodomy was frowned upon. When Socrates examined this subject, he, of course, had great praise for male friendship and male love, as did Greek society. Socrates said, "This is a great good. However, if you sexualize this relationship, that is not a great good. That, in fact, is a great evil. You are really short-circuiting the thing toward which the friendship is aimed, which is the good and the beautiful. And you are demeaning that friendship." So Socrates was unambiguous in his condemnation of sodomy. So the whole point in these live call-in shows have been talking with homosexuals or lesbians, I try to make the point that a love for another person, whether it's of the same gender or not, of course, is one of life's great gifts, and there's nothing wrong with it. But if in sexualizing that love you can meet neither the unitive nor procreative aspects of sex, this is nature's way of telling you the love you have for that person is not spousal, and that therefore it's wrong for you to sexualize it. Within families, there shouldn't be, aside from a husband and wife, a sexual relationship, or between relatives, or between children and adults, or between, there are all kinds of other relationships in which love exists laudably, and that to sexualize that love would be a grotesquerie.
I think you also make a very good point that the voice of conscience has to be silenced, through not only persistent sinning, but also this proud promotion of and celebrating of sin. I've got a priest friend who says the same thing, that this aggressive push to legalize same-sex marriage and kind of force everyone else to accept it and even celebrate it is really at bottom an attempt to muffle the voice of conscience. And another excerpt I want to read from your book here, you say, rationalizations for moral misbehavior work like this. Anyone who chooses an evil act must present it to himself as good. Otherwise, as Aristotle taught, he would be incapable of choosing it. When we rationalize, we convince ourselves that heretofore forbidden desires are permissible. In short, we assert that bad is good. And then you go on to explain that when this goes on for a protracted period of time, conscience essentially becomes obliterated.
Yes, and as Aristotle made clear in the Ethics, we're incapable as human beings of choosing something that's without presenting it to ourselves as a good. So we deceive ourselves. And the point is, conscience usually intervenes. We regret what we've done. We admit it was wrong, and moral order is restored. But if we center our life on a disordered act, if we become professional thieves, or say a hitman, then we must construct a rationalization that more permanently obliterates our conscience and justifies our continued behavior. Now, in the instance of male homosexual acts, they then have to justify the act of sodomy and construct a rationalization for it as a moral good. Now, the only way they're secure in that rationalization is if they can enforce it on everyone else. They have to universalize the rationalization. Otherwise, there are sources of potential rebuke that might trigger their conscience and thus deconstruct the rationalization, and they would then have to face the consequences of the character of their behavior. So they have to spread it, and they have to silence those who might speak against it or remonstrate with them about it. And as we have seen, in very short order, this has been successfully done with the social institutions in the United States, with the businessmen and the corporations, with the Boy Scouts, with many church denominations, and then throughout the government, foisted on the military, promoted by the courts, and now enforced in such a way that we see in a state like California that a young teenager who wants to do something about their homosexual inclinations cannot, because it's against the law to receive therapy that might help him. And we know people being punished who don't want to join in commercial activities involved with homosexual marriages because they're Christians or they simply believe it's wrong and they don't want to be complicit in that wrong. And now they're being penalized for that. And this is going to get much worse.
It's frightening, really.
Lies are frightening, and enforced lies are great evils, and this lie is being enforced on us now. So actually the only institution in American society left that is willing to speak this truth and preserve the truth about marriage and human flourishing is the church.
Right.
And therefore it is the object of tremendous derision and obloquy and criticism.
Yeah. You're listening to Forward Boldly. We are speaking today with Robert Riley, author of the book Making Gay Okay. In the second part of your book, it's titled Marching Through the Institutions, and I want to turn for a moment just to the Supreme Court. Of course, as we know, in 1986, the Supreme Court upheld a state anti-sodomy law in Bowers v. Hardwick, and it said explicitly that the Constitution does not confer a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy. And Chief Justice Berger wrote a concurring opinion examining what he called the ancient roots of prohibitions against homosexual sex. He even quoted William Blackstone, who said that homosexual sex is an infamous crime against nature, worse than rape, and a crime not fit to be named. And of course, we know 17 years later that case was overturned, but it's almost mind-blowing to think that at one point we had public officials who could write that, whereas today, if any Supreme Court justice were to write that, people would be screaming for their heads. I mean, they would say he's a bigot.
In the dissenting opinions to Windsor about a year ago is what declared unconstitutional the Federal Marriage Act, defining marriages between a man and a woman. You can listen to Justice Scalia and some of the other justices in their dissenting opinion objecting to this. But in fact, it's the same justice writing in the Lawrence decision as writing in the Windsor decision who first found a right to sodomy in the Constitution and then found a right to that as the basis of marriage or other homosexual acts as the basis of marriage. And we know is what I try to show through the chapter on the court decisions is the logic that has worked its way up to Justice Kennedy and those two decisions, beginning with Griswold versus Connecticut in the 60s, when the court found that there was a right to contraception for married couples. They needed a prescription, but they could get it, followed by another court decision saying, we can't simply restrict this to married couples. All adults
right.
have
Eisenstadt
a right to contraceptives.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, another decision saying, well, children have rights, too. We can't deny them contraceptives. So now anybody can have a contraceptive. That, of course, was followed by the decision overturning all the laws against abortion, because why should anyone be penalized? Because their contraception failed. So it's okay to kill the unborn child. And then, of course, we, in tandem with this, had the decisions or the changes in laws on marriage, So no-fault divorce and fast increase in the number of divorces and serial polygamy, basically. Leading us ultimately to the Lawrence decision in which Justice Kennedy found this putative right to sodomy in the Constitution disguised under the right to privacy. And then, a decade later, saying, if this right really is okay, if you have a right to engage in homosexual acts, well, why can't they be the foundation for marriage? And so he answers, they can be. And therefore, the federal laws discriminating against them must be unconstitutional. So there we are. And Justice Scalia, as usual, in his dissenting positions, can predict exactly what's going to happen next. And in Windsor, he said, this now is going to be the basis for obliterating all the state laws and state constitutions defining marriages between a man and a woman. And almost on a daily basis, we see this now taking place. Oregon, Pennsylvania, Utah, one after the other, the federal district courts say, your state constitution is unconstitutional because of this. And also, Justice Scalia predicted, and this has already come partially true in Utah, that there are no grounds for denying polygamy. And already there's been a federal district court judge regarding Utah's laws against polygamy and declaring them partially unconstitutional, which is particularly ironic because Utah wasn't allowed as a state in the Union without incorporating in its constitution a prohibition against polygamy. So this is, we're just, all of this is logical. It's almost inevitable in its logic. It's just the premise is insane.
Exactly. Polygamy will definitely be the next domino to fall. I think most of us saw that, but in the beginning, people said, oh, no, that's not going to happen. But
and polyandry also.
Sure, sure, yeah. Absolutely. You had some interesting things to say as well about the American Psychiatric Association. And, you noted that in 1973, homosexuality was removed as a disorder from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, where it had been in place since 1952. And you basically show that this was not a move based on scientific evidence, but rather on pressuring and lobbying by gay activists. Could you unpack this for our listeners who may not be familiar with this? How did the gay agenda win such a victory in the APA?
Well, it won such a victory for several reasons. Number one, there were closet homosexuals within the organization working for these changes. In fact, the president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association at the time was himself a homosexual, as his granddaughter later revealed in some rather stunning radio interviews, which I quote in the book. Homosexual psychiatrists and psychologists who may have wished to see this change nonetheless objected to it because it was not made on the basis of any science or research, that it was done through sheer political muscle. Therefore, they abhor the change because they say this traduces science. This is not science. We don't take a vote on whether something's a disorder or not. We look at the research in order to determine it. And that, of course, is not what was done in this case. They were targeted by the homosexual movement, which explicitly said, we're not going to be able to obtain our so-called rights if this can be defined by psychiatry as a psychological disorder. Therefore, we have to overthrow this decision. And they succeeded. But it had absolutely nothing to do with science.
Right. Let's turn for a moment to your thoughts on the U.S. military. Of course, you know, in your advisory positions, and of course, you've been in the military, you have kind of a bird's eye view of what's going on there, and you talk of the queering of the military. You know, I wanted to bring up with you a recent study that revealed that I believe sexual assault cases in the military doubled in the last year, at least the reports of them, and that the greatest number of them was actually male-on-male sexual assault. So do you believe that that's one of the consequences of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell? And could you also talk just a little bit about how you see this the homosexual agenda making headway in the military?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to ask yourself why for a couple of centuries and more in the military code of justice, sodomy was prohibited and outlawed and considered prejudicial to good military order. Why was that so? Why did George Washington throw out of the Continental Army an officer convicted of sodomy? Well, as you pointed out, I'm both a veteran. I served in the military, and I've also worked with the military later in life. But I had another experience. In fact, after I got out of the military, I was a professional actor in New York. So I saw the homosexual subculture operating there openly and saw how it worked, what its rules were, how it recruited and dispensed its favors. I wasn't shocked by this. Any group looks after its own. It's that how they defined their own was defined in terms of their homosexual behavior. In fact, I left one theater after a season being told, Bob, it's too bad you're not a you're a good actor. It's too bad you're not a homosexual.
Wow.
Because you would have gotten, you know, better roles here. But again, I wasn't shocked. Those were the rules of the game there. However, having been in the military, I know what deleterious consequences would occur if you let that homosexual subculture operate openly in it. And that's what President Obama has achieved by revoking the Don't Ask, Don't Tell legislation, which allowed homosexuals to serve as long as they didn't act homosexually or openly espouse it. So I was fine with that compromise. What's the problem? It doesn't allow the subculture to openly operate and therefore create this underground homosexual preference, which is prejudicial to good military order. Now that's over. Now it's operating openly. And, of course, it's to inject sexual tension in the military, particularly in a combat unit, is insane.
Yeah.
And that is what this is allowing. This is why, by the way, the strongest opposition to allowing this came from the Marines, who often end up in the most intense combat. So what it demonstrates to me is that the homosexual movement won't stop at anything to universalize its rationalization. If it's going to affect the combat effectiveness of our military, well, that's too bad. That's just part of the price. Just as the spread of their propaganda in primary schools and even kindergartens, won't they stop at the innocence of children? Nope, that's just simply one of the prices for the universalization of this rationalization. It's very grim, and that is why the church had better get ready, because it's going to get a lot rougher for it.
Yeah, I think for you and me, it just seems like such common sense. In the military, you mentioned the intensity of the combat environment, and if you just think they're already in a pressure cooker situation, the testosterone is through the roof, sort of has to be, and you include, you know, sexual tension into that. It just doesn't surprise me that there are so many more reports now of male-on-male rape in situations like that.
Right.
Well, excellent book. I commend you once again for writing it and publishing it. And I was wondering, could you tell our listeners where they can get ordering information for your book?
Yes, thank you so much. Of course, you can go to the Ignatius Press website and order it directly from there. Or, of course, it's available on Amazon and, you know, any number of other internet book sale sites. And it should be in quite a number of stores, because Ignatius Press has very good distribution. And again, I would just simply urge your listeners, if they need to know what the rational arguments against this are, this is what I dedicated the book to equip them with those.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciated speaking with you today. Thanks for being on the show.
Good luck. God bless you. Thank you.
God bless you. You've been listening to Forward Boldly with Christine Niles. Remember that you can find more about our network and access all our archived shows at forwardboldly.com. Please also check out our podcasts at the Regina Magazine blog, found at blog.reginamag.com. Okay, my friends, keep fighting the good fight of the faith. And in the words of Saint Joan of Arc, in God's name, forward boldly.